prevent a person from going to buy a gun because they feel so angry about being ignored, but to just have a program, an organized program across the country to reduce, well, I'm not going to go into the whole thing about gun laws, but just to really have students who were bold enough to model the bus campaigns against nonviolence, students who were bold enough to organize bus and plane trips to cities to discuss and encourage people to change the gun laws in America and other places.
I think there's two threads there, and there's, you know, nonviolence as a philosophy, both as sort of a way of life, but also as a vehicle for change by refusing to engage in violence and making that your worldview and the way that you move through the world. That's a great way to make the world better for everyone. If everyone were to choose nonviolence and focus on nonviolence as the paradigm through which they work, but also organized nonviolence.
Yes.
And the power of the message that nonviolence sends, that you are willing to do everything, including not hurting the people who oppose you, in order to achieve what you believe is right. And to have such firm conviction in what you are doing and what you believe that you don't need to resort to violence to achieve it, because you are confident that it is the right thing. And if you continue to present it as the right thing, eventually people will recognize that, right?
Yes. And the power, hearing and seeing youth, the bus rides that were organized by teenagers for climate change, they didn't go through all of the permitting and so forth. They said, we're going to be there at 1 o'clock, and, you know, they were there. So I think some parents might have been fearful of having their child out of school and taking part in a march, but that was, to me, a connection to the kind of ways that parents connected with their kids who, at elementary school, college, in other places, took the days off or took the week off to take part in learning how to be specific techniques of not being violent, specific techniques of getting signatures. So I just think that that's a good model, something for us to talk about rather than pop news, 5 minutes, this
sure.
Door has broken into whatever.
Yeah, and reinforcing the importance and value of organizing.
Yes.
And the importance of community to organizing and of organizing to community, right? Where, as you're saying, by, you know, taking kids out of school and giving them training on how to participate in democracy, how to enact change in society, you're underlining that those are valuable skills. Those are valuable abilities to have, and there's value to be had by bringing that to society. So I endorse what you're saying there for sure.
Right. And it's so important now that so many things are changing, and we have to hold on to our democracy. And so I was going to say one other thing that was different. When the Southern Christian Leadership Group went to cities and they were going to close a bowling alley, take some kind of action, they also had a place in the church auditorium or somewhere where they taught you how to fall, how to join arms, and how to cover and protect your face and neck. And so where some people would say, oh, I don't want you to go down there and be learning that stuff because you could get killed, there were hundreds of people who did not get healed, thousands of people who did not get killed because, or hurt badly because they had been taught holding arm to arm, putting your face and knees down. There's something that you feel from the energy of that person. And so it's not something people today listening to their devices are listening to anything but that. So I'm just saying this is something in Vancouver that's very doable. We have a lot of festivals and a lot of places. We have places where we encourage people for songs. We're going to be listening to some more songs. Somebody said, please let it get on to the songs. But I think another important thing that people don't know about college and community radio and this radio station, CJSF.ca, that there's an open door policy where people who've written the song, people who have made music and want a chance to have it heard, can bring it. Tell us briefly about that, because that's an element of democracy that some people think, oh, it won't work. But just can you briefly say how people, if you've got your freedom song or your love song and you want a chance to have it played?
Sure. You can get in touch with our music director, Connor. His email address is cjsfmusc@sfu.ca, cjsfmusc, music without the I, at cjsf.ca. There's also a form on our website, cjsf.ca, that you can fill out and submit your music through there, and then it'll get processed by our music processing team. And you can also reach out directly to hosts of programs. A lot of their contact information is at cjsf.ca if they want that to be public. Or you can reach out to me if you're interested in getting some music on the talk program, cjsfpa@sfu.ca, cjsfpa@sfu.ca. And on that, let's get to some music, huh?
Yes.
Cool.
Marching up to freedom land. Ain't gonna let no.
This is Charlotte Farrell, your own sister C, here at cjsf.ca, the place to be. Today, we are doing a special tribute to the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in memorial of his death on April 4, 1968. This segment is on legacy and reflection. Okay, as we reflect on Dr. King's legacy, we have to remember his final speech delivered on April 3, 1968, the night before his brutal assassination. In "I've Been to the Mountaintop," people whispered to each other, felt something different. Is he dying? When he concluded that speech, he spoke, however, of hope and resilience. Let's listen to an excerpt from this poignant address.
Let us rise up tonight with a greater readiness. Let us stand with a greater determination. And let us move on in these powerful days. These days of challenge to make America what it ought to be. We have an opportunity to make America a better nation. And I want to thank God once more for allowing me to be here with you. You know, several years ago, I was in New York City autographing the first book that I had written. And while sitting there autographing books, a demented black woman came up. The only question I heard from her was, "Are you Martin Luther King?" And I was looking down writing, and I said, "Yes." And the next minute, I felt something beating on my chest. Before I knew it, I had been stabbed by this demented woman. I was rushed to Harlem Hospital. It was a dark Saturday afternoon. That blade had gone through, and the x-rays revealed that the tip of the blade was on the edge of my aorta, the main artery. And once that's punctured, you're drowned in your own blood. That's the end of you. It came out in the New York Times the next morning that if I had merely sneezed, I would have died. Well, about 4 days later, they allowed me, after the operation, after my chest had been opened and the blade had been taken out, to move around in the wheelchair in the hospital. They allowed me to read some of the mail that came in, and from all over the states and the world, kind letters came in. I read a few, but one of them I will never forget. I had received one from the president and the vice president. I've forgotten what those telegrams said. I'd received a visit and a letter from the governor of New York, but I've forgotten what that letter said. But there was another letter that came from a little girl, a young girl, who was a student at the White Plains High School. And I looked at that letter, and I'll never forget it. It said simply, "Dear Dr. King, I am a ninth grade student at the White Plains High School." She said, "While it should not matter, I would like to mention that I'm a white girl. I read in the paper of your misfortune and of your suffering. And I read that if you had sneezed, you would have died. And I'm simply writing you to say that I'm so happy that you didn't sneeze. And I want to say tonight, that I too am happy that I didn't sneeze, because if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1960 when students all over the South started sitting in at lunch counters. And I knew that as they were sitting in, they were really standing up for the best in the American dream, and taken the whole nation back to those great wells of democracy which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1961 when we decided to take a ride for freedom and ended segregation in interstate travel. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1962. The Negroes in Albany, Georgia decided to straighten their backs up. And whenever men and women straighten their backs up, they are going somewhere, because a man can't ride your back unless it is bent. If I had sneezed, if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been here in 1963. And the black people of Birmingham, Alabama, aroused the conscience of this nation and brought into being the Civil Rights Bill. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have had a chance later that year in August to try to tell America about a dream that I had had. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been down in Selma, Alabama to see the great movement there. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been in Memphis to see a community rally around those brothers and sisters who are suffering. I'm so happy that I didn't sneeze. And they were telling me, now it doesn't matter now. It really doesn't matter what happens now. I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were six of us. The pilot said over the public address system, "We're sorry for the delay, but we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane. And to be sure that all of the bags were checked, and to be sure that nothing would be wrong on the plane, we had to check out everything carefully. And we've had the plane protected and guarded all night. And then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out, or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
That was an excerpt of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s final speech, "I've Been to the Mountaintop," delivered on April 3rd, 1968, the night before his tragic assassination. Obviously, heart-wrenching. You spoke earlier at the beginning of the episode, Charlotte, about hearing of his assassination and the reaction on campus and the reaction of people generally. Obviously, the terrible news to receive, and I can't even really put myself into that space. It's so sort of far removed from my own experience. But, you know, I don't want to necessarily focus on the tragedy of it all. Despite, and maybe in some part because of his assassination, Martin Luther King Jr. continued to be this enormous figure and symbol of hope and change and civil rights generally. For you, on that day, in the following weeks, months, how did you stay hopeful? Because I feel like we're not in exactly the same space right now, but there's a lot of fear about that, you know, the way the world is going, whether it's climate change, whether it's the same sort of civil rights for various groups. How did you move forward?
Well, first, from that particular night, it was... I guess the word that sticks in my mind is bedlam, because walking from the Black Student Association office, which was in one of the buildings on campus at Wayne State University, people were just breaking out crying. You could see people along the sidewalk, some crying, and then you could hear windows breaking some places. So there was a tear between, oh, we've got to heal so people don't, you know, just tear down or be in such despair. And you know, what's going to happen? It's just millions of questions going through our heads as we were going through trying to give comfort or give directions, you know, to people to go home, listening for other pastors and community groups were firstly urging people not to riot, because riots were breaking out in some cities, so it was a scary time. And I think that just that there was such a layering in from Dr. King to keep going, because when he said, I may not be there with you, but I'll be there, you know, all the same, that it made me listen more, because one of the organizations, there was a Black student organization nationally that was at the table. I think there were enough things that had been put in place that there were people at the table from all different organizations, the Nation of Islam. Just, I felt sad, really terribly sad, but also hopeful that such a system had been set up for recognizing all these different organizations, that they would continue to meet and come up with strategies, which did happen.
And sometimes it does take, in all sorts of ways, sometimes it takes tragedy to bring people together or to bring organizations together in that way. But certainly, as you're saying, a huge thrust of the work that Dr. King did was bringing all these disparate groups together and uniting around this core idea, this core value of civil rights and fundamental human rights.
Right. And nonviolence, you know, that we live in such an eye for an eye society, but that listening post, I think that one of the things as a speaker, a writer, I look for ways to engage children, because I think of, because people involved me as a child or other teenagers as I was older, to make sure the things that we're doing to deal with the strikes, deal with so many things that are happening around us, to keep children in the conversation and to realize that children speaking out, doing their poems, having meetings, reading about leadership, that it does help make it possible to have such a shift as the civil rights movement had and the way it influenced other movements. So I just am encouraged by seeing children that are curious, but now that the adults will give them more direction in coming together and talking, how important it is coming together and talk, to just not just let the digital news updates of, are we in tariffs, are we not in tariffs, is it 25% or is it 90%? Forget the percents and look at, how can we work, what do we have, what strengths do we have if we unite and we plan.
Great. And that brings us nicely towards our conclusion. I think we'll do one last piece of music.
Yes, this last song that we're ending with, We Shall Overcome, ties together the beginning of Dr. King's work with the Montgomery boycott. It's a song sung as people were marching and picketing. It's sung by a lot of groups who connected it to their movement or issues. So we're going to hear, and you could stand wherever you are and sing, We Shall Overcome.
Thank you.
That was We Shall Overcome. The ringing, resonating, lasting message of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., whose tragic passing by assassination we are remembering today on the anniversary, April 4th. Charlotte, do you have any final thoughts as we wrap up?
Just remembering and sharing Dr. King's words, the time is always right to do what is right. Thank you for joining us today to honor Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Yeah, thanks for putting this together, Charlotte. It's been great to sit with you and hear these speeches again and talk about them and hear your own direct personal experience with some of that has been really great. And, you know, you said the time is always right to do what is right. And here, the time is always right for love time, poem time.
Right. When people ask me what time it is, I always say it's time for love time, poem time.
Love time, poem time, love time.